So when we got back from our epic hitchhiking trip, I think we were gone about 6 weeks. It had really been kind of a transformative thing. It was very empowering just to be thousands of miles from home with very little money and knowing that you can rely on strangers to help you out, that you can put yourself in a situation where people will offer you help. And, you know, there's a we read some books on it, but the biggest art of hitchhiking is to be patient, you know, and not have any expectation of ever getting a ride, enjoying where you're at, enjoying standing around in the sunshine. We like to stand at the top of the exit and write signs and get picked up. So we got home, and just being in a house seemed really weird. I think I spent the first night in the backyard. And the next day I called my friend, Mike Leonardi, my activist buddy. We were talking about getting an apartment together and wanted to see where we were at. And then I had come back early. We had planned on being gone longer, but we were getting on each other's nerves. And so he was down in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which was the national headquarters for SEEK, the Student Environmental Action Coalition, the group that we had been active with. And he was down at their kind of national meeting. And so I hitchhiked out the next day and left that morning. My mom was a little disappointed, but I was at this point, now I'm ready to be on my own. And I had that was my first solo trip, met some great people, this guy, George Mosley, this truck driver from Alabama that I corresponded with for a long time. He just couldn't believe that somebody who was like in a master's program, who was intelligent and articulate and good conversationalist would be out hitchhiking. Usually it's people with mental illness or people who are really down in their luck. And he just found, you know, me a lot of fun and always wanted me to come down and visit. Sorry, I never was it followed up with that. Also got picked up by Al Gore's next door neighbor, this guy who had a gentleman's cattle ranch next to Al Gore's gentleman's cattle ranch, and had some great stories. And when he found out I was a sociology master's student, he hit me up for some free counseling, and I got a long ride for him that was really helpful. But when he dropped me off, I felt like I should have invoiced him for counseling services, and I felt like he had gotten more out of it than I had, which is cool. I got picked up by some other guys who gave me a beer, and I made it to Chapel Hill and kind of dropped in and on the national meeting and plugged in at that level, which was kind of new. I had been involved in kind of regional organizing but going to national meetings and participating, it was a little bit of a faction. There were these kinds of more organizational internationalist types, and then there were the more earth first direct action radical types, and that was kind of more my cup of tea. And looking back on it now, I can see that we might have been overly exuberant with some of our idealism and about how and question the value of organizational infrastructure, which you know, as history points out with that group, we might have not been on the right side of history on that one. But you make the best decisions, and it was vital, and it seemed I was passionate, and it seemed right at the time. So caught rides back most of the way and hitchhiked home, and then started my last year of grad school. Finally got a teaching assistantship. I had been a poor student as an undergrad because mostly I worked in the group homes, and nobody in my family really went to college, and I didn't live even in the same city that the college was at as an undergrad. So I was really, my self-identity was more about a working person more than that. And so I thought the goal of school was to obtain a piece of paper with as minimal amount of investment and cost as possible. But really what you're supposed to do in college is make your lifelong friends and figure out what tribe you're in. And so I finally did that. And I had two... And kindergarten was pretty fun. I mean, it was scary and anxiety provoking, but Mrs. Nutter was really sweet and was kind of motherly in a way that my mom was not, who was still pretty broken at that point. And I enjoyed it, you know, overall. I got some nurturing there and it was good. And I enjoyed my last year of grad school. Every other year of school I hated pretty intensely. I mean, I got some things out of it and it was transformative and I learned some stuff, but it was just unpleasant and I didn't enjoy it. But I really enjoyed my last year of grad school. I got 4.0, had an apartment near campus, was active in the environmental group, which led me to just be active and meet the other student leaders and it got me over my shyness, and stayed active in SEEK and regional organizing in a couple of different regions, because John was active in a chapter in Monroe County Community College, which was in this kind of Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and then I was active in Toledo, and we had a lot of overlap and joint activities because they were real close. But Ohio is like Ohio, Tennessee, Kentucky, West Virginia, and so I helped organize that whole area of the South and Midwest through grad school, and had a teaching assistantship and was really kind of political radical. Started to go to some more kind of pagan events, and went to some solstice events near Athens, Ohio, and that was neat, just to be able to see that there's this organized religious experience that I could take part in that felt natural and comfortable. And so after I got my master's degree, I had my first serious relationship with Krista, and we had planned this trip to go to Mexico, Belize, and Guatemala, and it was a comedy of errors. We were so ill-prepared. I was busy doing other things, and I've never been one into trip planning, and anyone who's ever traveled with me knows I bring an agreeable spirit, open to anything, but not a lot of trip planning, and so there was some... There were some struggles. We did 5 weeks in Mexico. We got some of us got robbed and got sick, and we ran short of money, and we broke up over the course of the trip, and it was weird and awkward, and I was in a funk. But it was weird too. Just when I remember, we had a lot of trouble getting across the border through bus tickets, and how we were going to pay for those, and just you can't buy an out-of-town bus ticket with a Discover card, and going and getting money to buy the ticket and missing the bus. And it was just a bunch of misadventure. And I remember we went to sleep on the bus after we'd finally make it, and I woke up and I looked up and there were mountains where we were, and I had no idea. And I realized that I didn't know the language, and I didn't know the geography, and I didn't know the history, and there was hardly anybody who spoke English, and I was reliant on a woman who was really questioning whether she wanted to be with me at any level at all. And it was a neat experience and culturally opening, but most of our trip was survival was the prize, and we limped back dirty and broken and flat broke. And then I arrived back, I'm out of school, we wrapped up our trip early, and I don't have a lot of money, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I applied for some jobs, and I had three choices in front of me from offers that I had put out and had offers on. I could have went to a wilderness adventure camp for at-risk kids in Pennsylvania, and then after a year of that, you could either go on a wagon train, or you could go out on tall ship sailing and become an adventure camp counselor, or I could move to Lima, Ohio and be a child abuse investigator, or I could take this job with SEEK, the group that I had organized with, a group of Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, and Missouri. Some kids in Ames, Iowa were organizing and had a job as a field organizer, and that was the least paid, and the grant didn't come through, so even half of what was was the lowest offer, half of that was on the table when I said yes. And before I arrived, even that half had evaporated because they hadn't raised the money, but the kids were plucky and they promised to do their best. And so my mom gave me a couple $100 to get me started, and I hitchhiked to Ames, Iowa, and became a field organizer for the Student Environmental Action Coalition. Had a heck of a time. Did some stuff in Ames with the locals who were supporting me, and then went on to Nebraska to organize against NAFTA, the biggest, place to export corn to Mexico, and would have the biggest benefit of NAFTA in all of North America. And I had a heck of a time trying to sell people on opposing it. So there was a House district that seemed like it was swing, and that was the strategy. But Bill Clinton bought him a bridge, and he voted for it. And so I went to a series of places and lost, kind of evaporated my housing, didn't have a lot of support, and had trouble making it on my own, and they ran out of money and hitchhiked home. And then the kids in Ames raised me some money to get me on the road. And before Christmas, I went and to St. Louis and worked with some kids at Washington University and had some success. We organized a little citywide network in a couple of weeks and really hit it off with Sarah Bance and Eric Hempel and people who are still my good friends today. But I made this, you know, group of friends. Went home for Christmas, stayed a little long as they tried to raise some money to get me on the road because I couldn't hit my mom up for a starter steak because I'd never paid her back from the last one. And they finally did. And then there was this Klan rally in Columbus. So I caught a ride with these communists out of Detroit who were going down to protest the Klan, figuring that I could catch a ride for someone else from another direction and end up closer to where I was going. I don't go to those kind of events. I think it's better to not draw a lot of attention. But it was interesting. And as I rode down, you know, the guy who was giving me a ride, he's like, I'm a gay communist Jew. This is an existential threat to my survival. And that helped me open my eyes to, you know, what we would call Antifa now, the early, you know, the real alliance of communists and anarchists who organize and try to keep, not allow fascists to have an organizing space in our open society. So it really, you know, was interesting and instilled questions that I don't have answers to about what to do about that kind of dangerous ideology in a land that we prize and protect free speech. Caught a ride to as close as I could get to Columbia, Missouri, which is where I was heading. I'd never been, was Springfield, Ohio, and I caught a ride there with some friends at Wittenberg University and stayed. And I stayed an extra night because this snowstorm hit, and then it looked like the snow was breaking for the day, and I set out, but it got immediately cold, and it was like 10 below zero, and I'm walking through the snow, and I only made like 50 miles in my first day, and I had to get a hotel room because there's no way I had I could camp, you know, in the 10 below weather. And the next day I had a terrible time. I was on bad highways and the roads were, there was hardly anybody out there. And I kept saying I would only stay at exits that had services. But as soon as someone would pull over, I would be so cold. I would jump in the car and they would go like one exit and there would be nothing at the service. And I'd start walking down the highway and I'd be like, hope I get a ride before I die. Hope I get a ride before I die. It was, and this old man picked me up. It was so funny. He's like, oh, you think it's cold now? You should have been in the trenches in World War One. He was that old. And he took me to an airport to thinking that I could get an airline ticket with what I had. And they didn't have any flights. But that I think it was just a ruse to get me used to the idea of taking a bus. And so I greyhounded into back to St. Louis to touch those kids again. And then I didn't even try to hitchhike to Columbia. It stayed in the negative degrees. And I spent my last, I had $200 to get started and to do this 2-week gig in St. Louis where this retired activist kid, Jeff Pavlik, had a place on North 8th Street where I could stay and do my organizing. We were thin on the ground in Missouri outside of St. Louis. But there, he had been to a national conference and agreed to host. So I got off the Greyhound. I had $6. I had spent $194. It would have been cheaper to have just bought a bus ticket to Columbia, but you never know, you know. And I had $6 and 2 weeks to stay in Columbia. And Jeff Pavlik and his housemate, Trevor Harris, and Jonathan and this this crazy dude stayed with this great group of activists and we dumpster dived and got a big like box of tortillas and ate tortillas and beans and I think I lost my $6 in poker. I lived on nothing for 2 weeks and I lived well and I fell in love with Columbia. You know, I was staying on North 8th Street and I was walking downtown and in the second week I was there, I walked downtown to try to hustle up some activity and I ran into somebody I knew and I stopped and talked to him and I ran into somebody I knew and I stopped and talked to him and I thought, man, this doesn't happen in Monroe, Michigan. This doesn't happen in Toledo, Ohio. It really felt at home, you know, being a college town by a field organizer for SEEK made me a college town aficionado. And even, you know, just visiting a lot of them and understanding coming to the college life, you know, in my third year of my master's program, you know, it was neat. And I liked the college schedule and I enjoyed college towns and what they had to offer. And I just fell in love with Columbia. And Jeff Pavlik and Trevor Harris, and we came up with this idea of Ozark Summer, which would be like Mississippi Summer or Redwood Summer, where we would have a summer-long camp out with environmental education and community organizing and direct action. And so organized that out of Columbia, and we had this great summer-long camp out that was pretty transformative of creating our own culture and doing activism and really getting committed to it. And it was, I think, transformative for other people that had been involved with it, even if it never lived up to its dreams that we had for it. At the same time that this was going on, protests had really taken off in my town of Monroe. There was the Fermi 2 nuclear power plant, and on Christmas Day 1993, a turbine threw a blade that smashed around, and it led to millions of gallons of water becoming contaminated with radiation, and the plan was to pump it into Lake Erie, because the solution to pollution is dilution, and we opposed that. And I wasn't in town then, but my brother organized some protests, and it became this grassroots phenomenon where hundreds of people, which is never the biggest protest ever seen in Monroe in history. It goes back to the Newton Steel Strike of the 1930s to find anything close. There had never been any history outside of some labor activism in the 1930s that had ever happened in our area. Now, maybe the Indian Wars of the 18th century. But after that, it had been pretty quiet. And there was great protest movement arose. And when I was in town, I would organize on it and provide support. And over the course of Ozark Summer, we also organized this with a SEEK, what we call the Grassroots National Action Festival, where we had found that we could organize a conference and get 100 or 200 people to come, and then we could do a protest as part of that conference. And those were the biggest protests that we could have, because normally we could get maybe 50 people to a protest. But if we had a conference with 200 people from out of town, suddenly we have a 250-person protest. So we used that trick, got people to come all over the country, got Earth First and Greenpeace, which never worked together, all together on this great coalition. And we threw everything at them that we had before they reopened the plant. Because we thought if they're going to spend, you know, tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars to bring this broken plant, if we could hit them with this grassroots protest, then maybe we could change that calculus and they would just abandon the whole thing and stop making all of this nuclear radiation and putting the Great Lakes at risk. So the first day we did protests in Detroit, and we had chained people to the front doors of Detroit Edison's headquarters, including this guy who had paraplegia, and it was just a great event. And the second day, we did this. We have this in Monroe. It's the hometown of General George Armstrong Custer, and we have this big statue of him on a horse that it's in the central part of town in a big community gathering place. And so we covered him in yarn, and we did this protest on reweaving the web of life. And we brought this woman activist from the Mescalero Apache tribe, where they were trying to site a high-level nuclear waste facility, and Detroit Edison had been part of a consortium of these power plants. And so we're able to bring this critical examination of this thing that was happening under the radar, and she was just this amazing, powerful presence and gave this great speech, and it was this huge thing. It was not any arrests, but, you know, when you mess with Custer, you know, they said, oh, we covered it with toilet paper, and there was a lot of people in Monroe have that kind of pride, but it allowed us, we thought he was a touchstone for militarism, and then the next day we had promised weeks ago that we were going to barricade the plant at 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, And we had been blocking the gates of the plant a number of times. There had been probably 7 or 8 protests where people had got arrested. And through nonviolent civil disobedience, I had picked up a previous arrest and got injured by the police. We would set in front of the gates, and there were 2 gates, and so whichever gate had the least amount of people, they would arrest and pull those people out, drag them in police cars and arrest them, and then open the gate. And then they didn't care if we blocked one gate, we just couldn't block 2 in case they had for their operations and shift change and so forth. So they were expecting us to do that. Let me tell that story first, because at its one protest, I was blocked the gates, and rather than drag me off, you know, and put me in a police car, and because I would go limp and non-cooperate, and we had done nonviolence trainings, and you know, it was pretty standard. Instead, they decided to use pain compliance techniques to get me to move and obey, and so they put their thumb under my ear, and they lifted me off the ground by having their thumb under my ear, and when I touch it, it's still tender now, 30 years later. And because the police have nothing in their repertoire when people tell them no. And when they say, you need to move now. And I just said, no, I can't. And so they stood me up, and they had got me up, and I realized I was on my feet and I was holding my own weight. And he was giving me this pain pressure technique, and it hurt so bad. And there were 2 of them. And then I just kicked my feet out. And it was one of the braver things that I'd ever done, you know, but I was committed, and I was not going to move, even if they killed me. My cause was just, and if they did, it would just bring attention to the issue, and that is how you do nonviolent direct action, that you're so committed to your issue that you're going to do whatever it takes. And so when they saw that, they just dragged me to the car and pushed me in, and that was that. So they expected that same, because we had done that technique about 7 times, and they were lined up and had the cops out. And what we had done instead is we had worked with a lot of folks from Earth First, and we used a tactic from forest activism. And instead of going up to the gates where the police were posted up and waiting to drag us off into paddy wagons that they had had, and we probably had 400 people camping, so we probably had, I don't know, 500 or 1,000 people scattered all around there was no great place to gather, so people were all over. And so we borrowed a school bus that these other anti-nuclear activists who were more moderate than us had, and didn't tell them what we were going to use it for. And we dropped off, we had three 30-foot trees, and we put together these tripods like you're putting together a teepee, and we chained activists at the top of the tripods, and we blocked the highway leading up to the plant gates. And then I was in the second group, so we dropped those people off, and we set that up, and we had practiced that, and we could do it in like a minute. And before the police got there, we had our activists chained, and we had support people, and we were all, and the bus was rolling down the road because we didn't want to get the bus seized because it was a borrowed bus. And then we dropped off cement-filled barrels, and that we handcuffed ourselves to rebar that we had ran through the center of the barrel. And our barrels would have been much stronger if we would have had an extra $100 to buy stovepipe, but we couldn't afford the stovepipe. So they were able to get in the bolt cutters into the hole, our armholes, and they didn't have to blast through the cement to get to the handcuffs. And but we were there long enough to that the police cars, they had left with all their lights going, that their batteries had died and the police cars didn't start. And we created this mega traffic jam, which was part of our message, because it was the only, for the folks who live in the beaches area, there's the only way to get out is the highway that runs by the plant. If there's any even a car accident, then all those people would not be able to evacuate. So we wanted to point out the problems with their evacuation plan by making this major traffic cluster. And mission accomplished. So that protest was off the hook, you know, just organizing it and being broke and organizing constantly for all through the summer had just worn me out. And I was so relieved to like be taken to jail. But then as people got arrived to jail, they were macing and beating people. They had pushed over the tripods and maced the people when they hit the ground. And then they just started, there was a police riot, and the police just started macing and grabbing people. My brother had a set of handcuffs in his backpack, and his, we had organized by affinity groups, so we didn't know what everybody was doing. So we knew about the tripods and the barrels, but there were other groups who had other plans. And so my brother was going to wait until they loaded up the first car with protesters and then handcuff himself to the chassis of the police car. But he just got randomly maced and beaten and grabbed up. And then they were surprised to find the handcuffs, which was funny how we got our handcuffs, because my friend Steve Merricks worked in a porn store. And so we bought porn store handcuffs because we got the employee discount. We had to do everything on the cheap. You know, we organized this total fuck you protest with thousands of people from around the country for like $2,000 or $3,000, including like our cement filled barrels. It was amazing of what we would do. And so 16 of us ended up getting arrested. They arrested some media people. There was a Detroit news photographer who had got snatched up and beaten. And when the police beat you, they charge you with assault. And my friend Roger Prunty had gotten the hell whooped out of him, and he came in and he was just all maced, and not just a squirt of mace in his face, but they'd shot it up his nose, down his throat and his ears, and they had beat him with batons, and it was all on tape. He was standing by the side of the road, and they said, if you step one foot in the road, you're going to be arrested. And he's like, okay, I won't. And then the cop pulled back and just hit him with the stick and knocked him back on a ditch, and six of them are swinging sticks at him. And then he was ended up getting convicted for assault, because the police testified that when he said, okay, I won't, that spittle had come from his mouth and hit the police, and that was the assault. And the whole time he's laying in the fetal position saying, I'm not resisting, I'm not resisting, while the police just beat him with clubs. So Roger's assault conviction, I had been really into the idea of direct action, and I had been organizing bigger and bigger protests, and I had plans to use the success of this protest to build other protests and build a protest movement and radicalize, because the whole purpose of SEEK was to take kid recycling club members and turn them into radical direct action environmentalists, and because the threat to the environment, it seems like a crisis and seems like it's an existential threat to our very survival. And I think we're seeing that now with the climate change activists and the sense of urgency. But it's not like there's this qualitative or quantitative difference, but that it's been creeping on us, and there has been these issues, and we felt it passionately, and we're ready to do any means necessary. But when I saw the results of it and doing all the court support for all the people who got arrested who were from out of town, and you'd go to court with them, and all of the grief and trouble, and seeing Roger end up with an assault conviction, which could have affected his whole life outcome, really made me question if that was the tactic that I wanted to invest in. And I went on to do a few other direct action protests, but I really started to question whether that was a great tactic and whether I was believed in it, because it had taken on my, you know, part of what Jesus did is he organized a mass movement against a corrupt religious and political state that didn't take care of the poor and didn't provide justice. And so this had become part of what I had felt had been my mission, was organizing this this kind of movement and bringing this direct action movement that would restore some kind of participatory democracy and environmentally sustainable society that we were going to organize out of the ashes of the fallen state, and that we were going to put ourselves on the line to stop the most egregious and threatening behavior till we could build that perfect world in the future. And then I questioned whether that was really the strategy that I was going to be able to do, and would I be able to live with those consequences. You know, I'm 24, 25 years old, and I'm responsible, because for someone to take a serious beating, people could have been killed. And so the next year, other activists organized a big, similar style protest event, and I participated in that, but not without a lot of, but with less enthusiasm, because I did it because I had gotten this, helped get this thing started, and I felt I didn't want them to do it on their own and participated, but it didn't, I didn't have the passion and fire for it. One other thing kind of happened in that era. A farm family had reached out to John at Monroe County Community College, River Raise and Seek, that group, about some wetlands that were under threat by a development project. And we turned out a bunch of people for a couple public meetings, and we ended up saving this kind of small wetlands. And it was really the first success, besides speaking truth to power and rising the cost to do things that we didn't agree with. We had never really won anything, you know, and because when you have a radical agenda and you're young and you're not following the system, you get in late, don't have an achievable end, and you end up with less victories than you might. But we had that victory, and that meant more than a lot of the other stuff. And so that informed my thinking. I stopped working for the regional group and started to book my own, because I realized that I was raising all of the money that my host groups, you know, were struggling with to have their local, and they were unpaid volunteers who had costs and expense. And I just decided that I could just book my own with other states and regions. And so I did trips to New York, and I did a notable trip to Utah. I had a month field organizing trip in the state of Utah. And when I got out there, you know, I had one good contact at a school, and then I just worked the phones and identified contacts at other schools. And we picked an issue, which was the Utah Wilderness Act. When we did the Roadness and Wild Area Act, when wilderness first was created, they did a study and they looked at everywhere that was roadless, and they identified it as preemptively wilderness, and they put it under protection while they did more detailed studies and analysis in the political process to see what was determined about what would actually be named wilderness and protected forever as wilderness. And in Utah, there were 20 million acres that have mostly red rock desert that had been identified as potential wilderness because of its lack of roads. And there was a proposal on the table to preserve 4.5 of it as wilderness. Earth First said, let's preserve all 20 million. Sierra Club said, let's try to preserve 8 million. And there was some adult groups working on it, but the students hadn't been engaged. And so we engaged the students, and we turned out, we generated hundreds and hundreds of postcards by moving around to all the college campuses in the state of Utah. And then we turned out several hundred people in Logan, Utah for a public meeting. And the Utah delegation flipped on it. They were supportive of it, and then they opposed it. And as a courtesy, they wouldn't pass things that only applied to that state without the support of the local delegation. And so it was defeated in that month. And it was just great going from an idea to building, to jumping onto an existing campaign, and then adding this incredible amount of organizing energy, and then having a victory. The next year, they passed a 5.7 million acre, and there had been this newspaper article about where the Utah delegation referred to the number of postcards that they had received and the number of people that had turned out at this public meeting that I had packed. And then that was kind of my second taste of victory, and I realized that maybe there is something that can be done in electoral politics that has real consequence. Maybe it is more than just direct action. And maybe it's best to engage when you have the chance of actually changing and making some real wins on the ground instead of just speaking truth to power.